This is a coastal story, written and presented by Charlie Connolly. One night in the spring of 1777, a ferryman rowed his boat past Blockhouse Point in the Solent at the entrance to Portsmouth Harbour. A gibbet hung there, in which were the decomposing remains of 24-year-old James Aitken, better known as John the Painter, hanged a couple of months earlier for a series of arson attacks on British naval dockyards. The ferryman had had a busy day and he was in a good mood. As he rowed past the gibbet, he called out that poor John had had a hard fate, having so cold a berth assigned to him after his hot work. That wasn't the greatest joke in the world, but the ferryman was pleased enough with it, chuckling to himself as he heaved away on the oars. "Ah," boomed a voice from above, "and you may have as cold a berth yourself one day or another." It was a man waiting for the ferry, who'd heard the ferryman's call. It wasn't exactly the wittiest riposte to what wasn't exactly the greatest joke in the world, and the ferryman certainly didn't see the funny side, if there was one. He hadn't seen the man in the gathering darkness, and assumed this was the voice of John the Painter himself, from within the gibbet and beyond the grave. The ferryman rowed back to the other side of the harbour as fast as he could, went straight home, took to his bed, and didn't emerge again for days. It's hard to imagine now just how John the Painter captured the public imagination for a few weeks at the start of 1777. The thing was, as arsonists go, he wasn't a very good one. He had been a pretty good highwayman. His skills as a burglar were pretty decent too, but arson, especially on the scale he was attempting, proved to be a step too far. Now he was a pretty nasty piece of work, all told. A career criminal with an eye for the main chance, who was probably destined for the gallows sooner or later. But had John the Painter succeeded with his series of targeted arson attacks, Britain's status as a maritime power could have been compromised irreparably, and history itself could have been very different indeed. James Aitken was the son of an Edinburgh blacksmith who died in 1761 when James was 9 years old. The loss of his father saw James admitted to the Heriot's Hospital, a school for poor boys growing up without fathers. James Aitken was a bright kid, a keen reader, particularly fond of Voltaire. But, society being what it was, when he left school, the only opportunity open to him was as an apprentice to a house painter. Education had fostered ambition, and before long he abandoned his paintbrushes and set off to seek his fortune in London. Immediately he fell in with a rough crowd of petty thieves and housebreakers. Encouraged by his nefarious new friends, James tried his luck as a highwayman, and met with some success, branching out into burglary and shoplifting, and becoming so prolific he suspected detection was imminent, and decided to depart for America. While in America, he claimed to have taken part in the Boston Tea Party, before, fearing anti-British sentiment, he sailed home for Liverpool in May 1775, and recommenced his earlier career roaming the country, stealing from shops, burgling houses, and stand and delivering on the public highway. At an inn in Oxford one night, he earwigged on a conversation about how vital the British naval dockyards were to the war with the US. Indeed, the very future of the nation depended on them, they said. if anything serious were to befall the dockyards and the ships in them, like, say, a series of catastrophic fires, well, that would be that. The more I considered it, the more plausible became the undertaking, and the more eager I was to become the instrument of it, Aitken said in a confessional memoir, dictated in Winchester jail just before his execution. If he could burn down the naval dockyards of England, finally, James Aitken would be somebody. A hero in America. A man known throughout the world whose name would stay in the history books forever. He headed for Portsmouth, took a job as a painter, and commenced staking out the naval dockyard. From there he travelled to Plymouth, Chatham, Woolwich, and Deptford, convinced himself that his plan was a goer, and set out for Paris to offer his services to the American leaders based there. He tracked down Silas Deane, diplomat and leading campaigner for American independence, and pitched his services as an international arsonist. Deane's mouth hung open. This was, he said, an enterprise bordering on madness, and he'd never get away with it. Aitken claimed to have invented a powerful explosive incendiary, with a slow-burning fuse that meant he could be 60 or 70 miles away by the time the fire really caught hold. It was foolproof, he said. A few of these devices strategically placed, and Britain's sea power would go up in a big puff of smoke. American independence would be a doddle after that. Even judging by Aitken's own account of the meeting, Deane had clearly guessed he wasn't exactly in the presence of some kind of terrorist genius. Any support he offered was tacit and equivocal at best. Yet, convinced he had the full backing of the US leadership and would be handsomely rewarded, Aitken returned to Britain and immediately began casing the rope walk in Portsmouth, which seemed to be a good place to start a fire. When, on his first night infiltrating the premises, he managed to get locked in and had to holler for help, claiming he'd wandered in out of curiosity, it was a taste of the kind of thing to come. His plan was to burn down the lodging house in which he was staying, and then a local pub, to distract the town's firefighters, then head for the dockyard. While mixing up the flammable solutions in his room, however, his landlady hammered at the door, having smelled the concoction, demanding to know if he was intending to set his room on fire, and promptly threw him out. Having been distracted from his distraction, Aitken decided to go straight to the dockyard and set fire to the rope house. He set his device and was recognised on the way out by someone he used to work with and decided to hightail it from town until the coast was clear. He travelled all night until he reached Kingston, having seen a glow in the sky to suggest the dockyard was indeed in flames. From Kingston he travelled to London to call on Dr. Bancroft, a physician from Massachusetts, a name Deane had given him in Paris as someone he should talk to when he was in London. Convinced he would be welcomed as a hero, Aitken found that Bancroft, a double agent actually, working for both Britain and America, had never heard of him, and effectively closed the door in his face. Plymouth was next on Aitken's list. He was now a wanted man, having succeeded in causing extensive damage to Portsmouth Dockyard. And thanks to the man on the gate who'd recognised him, the nation was now aware of, and on the alert for, John the Painter. He stopped in Hungerford and found work there, assisting a house painter, who he robbed and then absconded. But when he arrived at Plymouth, he found the dockyard heavily guarded as a result of the Portsmouth fire. He had a rope ladder made with crampons to grip the top of the wall, but when he used it and was halfway over, the top of the wall gave way and he fell 12 feet to the ground. When he got his breath back, he found both the stores building and the hemp house he'd intended to burn far more heavily guarded than he'd anticipated. So he decided against burning down Plymouth Dockyard. From there he went to Bristol, setting fires on three ships in the harbour and a shop that he felt contained enough combustibles to burn down that entire district of the town. Returning the next day, he found only one of his devices had caused significant damage to one of the ships. He came back the following night for another go and was delighted to find a stack of barrels of oil at the quayside, ready for loading onto a ship. He set a number of his devices among them, but then found his matches had got wet and wouldn't light. Still convinced he was actually a competent arsonist, the following night Aitken set devices in several warehouses in the city. Only one took hold, belonging to a bookseller. It caused considerable damage to the warehouse and a few surrounding buildings, but the spectacular conflagrations he'd anticipated hadn't come to pass. Cutting his losses, he decided to make for Paris again, convinced that Dean would have heard about his escapades and be impressed enough to hand over a considerable reward. On the way, he cased a haberdashery at Colne in Wiltshire and robbed it at night for supplies. The wife of the owner had seen him acting suspiciously during the day, and when his description matched that of the notorious John the Painter, the alert went out. It wasn't long before Aitken was arrested at Andover in Hampshire. His trial at Winchester was a formality, and he knew he would hang. On the 10th of March, 1777, he was brought by cart to Portsmouth, the sentence being carried out at the scene of his first and, as it turned out, most successful fire. This would be no ordinary hanging. Instead of a regular gallows, John the Painter would swing from the top of the mizzenmast of HMS Arethusa in Portsmouth for repairs, a height of some 64 feet, the highest gallows ever used in Britain. First he was drawn around the blackened remains of the building he'd burned. Then he informed the commissioner of the dockyard, when he saw him outside his residence, that he'd hoped his actions might make the commissioners of His Majesty's dockyards more careful in the future. Which must have gone down well. Then, shortly before 1 o'clock in the afternoon, in front of a crowd estimated at 20,000, when Portsmouth itself only boasted a population of 13,000, James Aitken, alias John the Painter, highwayman, burglar, slightly rubbish arsonist, and now national celebrity, had a hood placed over his head, and thanks to several men and a system of pulleys, was winched by his neck 64 feet into the air. They left him up there for an hour. Then he was brought down and taken to a specially constructed gibbet at Blockhouse Point, at the entrance to the harbour, in view of the town and every vessel going in and out. His tarred corpse remained there for several years. It's not known what happened to his bones after that. One story has it that he was eventually removed by a gang of sailors in the 1820s and left in a sack in the corner of a Gosport pub. Next to the fire, of course, which was still a more significant conflagration than most of the ones with which John the Painter had hoped to make his name. Almost immediately after his death, a new and bigger scandal emerged. A clergyman named William Dodd, convicted and hanged for forgery. capturing the attention of the public just a few weeks after John the Painter. The fame James Aitken had craved didn't even last the summer. In fact, the only person to still gasp at the name of John the Painter was a petrified ferryman, bed covers pulled over his head, convinced he'd been addressed by him from beyond the grave, albeit with a particularly lame attempt at banter. That was A Coastal Story. I'm Charlie Connolly. Now, next week will be the last Coastal Stories of the current series. But fear not, we'll be back again after a short break with more brine-encrusted anecdotage. There are still a few tickets left for my only live event this year, taking place at Waterstones in Canterbury on the 16th of September. Hope to see you there if you're in the area. Tickets are a fiver, but redeemable against the price of a book, should you feel like buying one. I'll be telling stories from my latest book, The Channel, and also Attention All Shipping, the tale of my adventures among the shipping forecast areas. And if you can't make it, both are available from all good bookshops and internet retailers. There's no avoiding them, really, so you've no excuse. Thanks to everyone who's bought Coastal Stories a pint this week. I do really appreciate it. There's a link in the show notes if you want to show your appreciation and help keep this little splashy podcast going. It's fun to do, and I hope it's fun to listen to. These waves were recorded at Deal on the coast of Kent on the 2nd of September 2021.